Ever wonder how a Comic-Con comes together? Here are two guys that know, because it's what they do every day. It's the Con Men Podcast. Now for another possible rant on where the Suicide Squad movie went wrong, it's Greg Adams and Puff.
We are running into this podcast. We are hustling to get this done. It's the Con Men Podcast. Greg Adams over here, Puff over there. We've been planning this podcast for like a week.
Well, I kind of mentioned it offhand during our favorite heroes conversation, and it's been bugging both of us, so we're gonna hop into it and get to our favorite comic stories of all time.
Yes, this is it's something that you even took to the internet, and we've been sitting in the studio for what feels like 2 hours trying to sort out the rules for what we're gonna do, because whenever we talk about a list, I have to have rules. Before we get to that, though, we're chomping at the bit to get to it. Let's set up once again who we are and what we do. We are the Con Men Podcast. We are a division of GeekedCon, Shreveport's Comic-Con in Shreveport, Louisiana.
A division?
Yeah, I mean, technically.
We just do everything, including a podcast. We're not necessarily a division. This is just something we do in addition to.
Well, yeah, we're coming to you from the GeekCon World Headquarters in Shreveport. GeekCon 2020 is slated for August 21st through 23rd of next year, because we are recording this in December of 2019. You can find more info on the event at geekcon.com. But the reason we do the podcast...
And boy, do we have some info coming for you soon.
Yes.
If you don't follow our Facebook page, I would suggest you do that. If you don't have our app, I would suggest you download that, because it's going to be an amazing couple of months. That's all I'm saying.
And the point of the podcast, really what we try to get down to is... we pull the curtain back on what it's like to put a Comic-Con together. We give some insight into parts of the show that if you're somebody who's thinking about starting one, maybe you're somebody who's already running a Comic-Con event, or maybe you're just a fan of them and you go to these events and you wonder why some of these decisions are made the way they are, we try to pull the curtain back and explain ourselves. So hopefully it helps other people understand some things. We'll get to our topic on Comic-Cons coming up, but like we already talked about, we are ready to fight over this comic book story arc. So, okay, explain exactly what we're going to do, because this was your idea.
Well, we're going to tell you, the listener, our top five favorite story arcs from comic books. Doesn't necessarily have to be superhero comics, but just our favorite story arc, like i.e. My number one, I'll give that away as an example.
What? No, don't do number one.
You want to do number five?
No, let's say something like...
Well, let's just say, hypothetically, it's not on my list, could be yours, but like X-Men, the Dark Phoenix saga. Like, that's a story arc. We're not talking about X-Men as a whole, which may be your favorite comic, it may not be, but, you know, we're just talking about our favorite. Like, if you go to the store and look at trade paperbacks, they're broken up by story arc. That's what we're talking about here, our favorite stories.
So, as an example, we can look at some of our also receiving votes, because here's what we had to do.
Honorable mentions.
So, no, not honorable mentions. We're not there yet.
You made one of those?
Yeah. You just told me I was allowed to do that.
I said we're going to be here forever if
no,
you did
so
that.
The also receiving votes are ones where these can be used as an example for what we're talking about. So these are storylines that would be on the list, like Hellblazer, Dangerous Habits.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Sandman, The Kindly Ones. Mm-hmm. And Batman's Death in the Family.
It wouldn't be on my list, but yes, that is a story arc.
But that's an example.
Yeah.
And it actually almost made my honorable mentions list. Now, the reason that we're talking about honorable mentions is because you asked for a top five.
Yes.
And it's hard to put together the top five.
I had mine hammered down to a top five. It's when we threw in this whole honorable mentions thing
but
and tried to limit it.
But I need the honorable mentions because I had a tie at number five because I could not justify putting one over the other. And you said, okay, we could have honorable mentions. So then we put honorable mentions in.
See, if you haven't picked up through this, through the first four episodes, Greg overcomplicates everything. We couldn't just do a simple top five list. Now we got 30 books we're talking about because Greg couldn't narrow it down.
No, because I need to have, I can't just say like top five because there has to be, I need structure, okay?
Yeah,
I need
okay.
structure on this. So let's talk about honorable mentions. These would be books, these are arcs that matter to us, but we couldn't find space for them in the top five, but we definitely know that they deserve to be mentioned. we can go one for one here. You can do one, I can do one, if that makes it easier on you.
Yeah, whatever.
Okay, why don't you start?
Well, top at my honorable mentions list is Kingdom Come, because holy crap, was that a story. The artwork was great. The story was great. Everything about the packaging and the telling was just phenomenal. But wasn't good enough to quite get to that top five, but it is a great story.
I've got one, too, that for me was one of the best pieces of writing that I've ever experienced. Just like the context of this one was an interesting setup, and then the fact that it delivered Deadpool's Dead Presidents.
Mm, yeah, that's a good
written
one.
By comedian Brian Posehn. So the fact that you had a comedian coming in and you're like, well, is he going to be able, can he do it? Yes, he can do it. Yes, he delivered. It was one of the most insanely off the wall comic books, which, by the way, picking up off from an already absurd, like we're talking about Deadpool.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Everybody that puts their hands on it makes it crazier and crazier, which
well,
is part of its charm.
Except for Kyle and Yost, who did the X-Force version of Deadpool and the early versions of Deadpool. But like the more recent post-Daniel Way Deadpool, it is all absurd as can be. So Dead Presidents, one of my favorites.
All right. Next on my list, I got Long Halloween.
Funny story.
Is that your next
That's
one?
That's my next one.
It's just so freaking good. But I was looking at my top five, and there's just nowhere to fit it in. Because I could literally do a top five list of best Batman stories.
So this is actually where I came up with the question that I asked you about 30 minutes ago about the contemporary, did we read this while it was coming out question? Because this is one of them that I didn't read while it was coming out. I wasn't in a position to. Mm. So I didn't have the luxury of reading this as it was being produced. This is all after the fact, like being told how great the Long Halloween is and going and reading the Long Halloween.
God, it is good.
Does that take the edge off at all? Like, you weren't like...
I mean, there's kids now that weren't even around when Batman was starting to get movies in, like, the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, true.
Who are now, like, super into Batman and going back and reading the Frank Miller stuff and going back and reading, you know, the Jeff Loeb stuff and just all the great writers that have been on Batman, those fantastic stories.
Well, it just kind of took the edge off compared to some of what's in my top five, because I was reading the top five stuff waiting and aching for the next book to come out. So that's maybe why that ends up. The Long Halloween is phenomenal as a story goes.
Well, actually, all those Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale.
Well, let's not get all the way into those yet because some more may appear.
Next on my list is the second arc from Preacher, Until the End of the World, which, God, man, when Garth Ennis was on, and it was just a Preacher as a whole is a great story, but just that little slice of the story was mind-blowingly fantastic.
I did enjoy Preacher. I didn't get as deep into Preacher as I wanted to, but I was there for the first couple of volumes, and it's everything you said is dead on. One of my other honorable mentions, going back to Batman, The Killing Joke.
Mm.
Killing Joke is one of those, like, if you are a Batman fan, if you're a Joker fan, if you're a comic book fan, go read The Killing Joke. Like, you can find it pretty much anywhere.
Yes.
And it is one of the best pieces of writing that I've probably ever, and I mean, again, the strike against it is that I didn't read it contemporary, like I wasn't reading it in real time. I had to go back. People had to tell me how good it was. So that kind of took the edge off, and that's why it's outside of my top five.
God, Alan Moore is so great. He's going to appear later, ladies and gentlemen. But
yeah, he probably on both sides, it sounds like.
God, man, The Killing Joke is just, when you listen to people that are directing Batman movies or writing Batman stories now, it always goes back to The Killing Joke. That and the next one on my list, oddly enough, Dark Knight Returns from Frank Miller. Those are probably the two most influential pieces of Batman storytelling that has made the Dark Knight that we know and love today, the Dark Knight. It's just, you know, I had already had another Frank Miller Batman story in my top five, and I didn't want to overload it with, you know, just going all Frank Miller.
Frank Miller owns my top five, period, end of story.
I have two. I tried to limit it to no more than two story runs from an author, so I got my two Frank Miller runs, and sadly, The Dark Knight had to fall to the honorable mentions, but man, It is great.
The last couple honorable mentions I have are ones that almost made it into my top five because I feel strongly that my top five should be things that I was actively reading. Although there are two that will end up in my top five that I wasn't actively reading because they're going to take the place of these two that I was. The first volume of the book Revival from Tim Seeley, yeah. The guy, the mastermind behind Hack Slash. He had a great story.
And Grayson.
Revival is one of those stories. It is like the story of it's like a zombie story, but it's not a zombie story. People come back from the dead and just want to assume their lives. They just want to come back and live their life the way it was. But people have already moved on. Like, their families have moved on. People are in new relationships. Their job has hired people to take their jobs. And now these people show back up ready to live their life. It is a phenomenal read. The first volume is when it's at its peak. It gets really, really good. The end is not, I would have loved to see it go on a little longer. I mean, it was kind of wrapped up.
Yeah.
But the first volume, it's the first 11 to 12 issues, some of the best writing that I think I've ever experienced.
Speaking of great writing, before you knock out your next one, I'm going to give you my last honorable mention. Captain America Winter Soldier.
Yep.
Ed Brubaker.
Brubaker.
Holy crap, man. If when they were relaunching Captain America, who's had his ups and downs, let's be fair. Sometimes the writing and storytelling in Captain America is phenomenal. Sometimes it's not good at all. And you know, Captain America had been gone for a little while. Then Ed Brubaker took over, and holy crap, all of a sudden he became, you know, one of Marvel's top comic book properties, and rightfully so. It was a fantastic story. Ed Brubaker's great in everything he writes, whether it's Captain America, Daredevil, his independent stories, but Captain America, Winter Soldier, wow.
I hated Captain America. He was like my absolute least favorite Marvel character until somebody forced an Ed Brubaker Captain America book into my hand and said, "You hate Cap? Read this." And I was hooked.
Yes. I mean, Ed Brubaker seemed like the guy, like whenever things were kind of slugging along, that they bring him in. I mean, Batman brought him in, DC brought him in for Batman, Gotham Central, a few other things. Then he got put on Daredevil. He got put on Captain America. And he kind of shot new life into all these, like, you know, long-term characters. And that's because he has a take on stories and the way to develop characters that is second to none. He's just fantastic.
You know, I just realized that I'm going to leave something out of here completely, but I should have made a mention of it at some point. My last honorable mention is the Umbrella Academy Apocalypse Suite. I really wish I would have held on to those Umbrella Academy books from back in the day because they are quite valuable now, but just reading that, and it kind of goes in line with what I said about Brian Posehn. Like, you hear the guy from My Chemical Romance is going to write a comic book, and you're sort of like, well, let's see where this goes. Let's see if he can get it done. And it was really good. And if you've seen the show on Netflix now and maybe have doubled back and read the books, like, that has opened a whole new group of people into the Umbrella Academy. But one thing I just realized that it's not in my top five. It's not in any of my honorable mentions. And I didn't mention it at all. And I really don't know where to cut this off at, what story arc per se it would be.
I wonder if it's the same one I feel like I left off.
Is it written by Robert Kirkman?
No.
The Walking Dead.
Oh.
The first 25 issues of The Walking Dead is incredible.
That's fair.
It's there's a reason that it went from comic book to TV show and one of the best TV shows of all time, first couple of seasons. There's a reason that it was that great, because the comic book, the source material, is so damn good. And the fact that it's all black and white, the fact Tony Moore's original artwork, like, that the first handful of issues that should have made somewhere. I don't know what I bump on my honorable mention. Maybe Deadpool Dead Presidents. Maybe that gets the boot for Walking Dead and the honorable mentions.
The one I feel bad for leaving off is Chew by our friend Rob Guillory. And what's his face? He used to write Batman. I don't know why it just left my brain.
Oh, man.
But Chew is a phenomenal story with great artwork. Again, I don't know how you even chopped that up in the story arcs, because it's kind of 150 episode story.
That's like Walking Dead. Like, where exactly do you cut off the first story arc.
Well, like the first six issues of Walking Dead are sort of their own contained story because they didn't think they were going to get but after that it kind of just
So I mean, I guess, yeah, if you want to consider the first six to be and maybe somebody's already done that and it is already a thing, but yeah. But
Chew is just a phenomenal story.
Invincible too, now that we're talking about Kirkman. Like Invincible was great.
My favorite Kirkman is neither of those, Thief of Thieves.
Yeah.
Which was my personal favorite Robert Kirkman production.
My personal favorite's Astounding Wolfman, so whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kidding. I'm really kidding. That's not at
all. I mean, there's options. You got plenty of options with that guy. And then he got famous and... Well.
Anytime I can bring up Astounding Wolfman, it's like Cyberfrog. I used to bring up Cyberfrog all the time. But okay, on to the top five. Do you want to start the top five?
Well, I start at the honorable mentions.
I'll start the top five.
Are we starting with one or five?
I'm starting with five and working my way to one. One is my favorite. Number five is The Watchmen.
Good choice.
And this is one that I felt bad about because I didn't read it in real time. So I didn't have the moments of, oh my God, I need to get my hands on the next issue. I need to read this now. I had to read it in a trade paperback. And the point I read it was very close to when the movie came out. So it was kind of a bang bang with the way that I read the trade and watched the movie. I'm one of those weird people who love the comic. And I don't mean weird, but there's probably a lot of us. We just on the internet, people take different positions. But I loved the comic books. And the movie.
Yeah. The movie, for as much crap as it gets, is a really good movie.
I love the movie. It's like Constantine. Like, people hated Constantine for whatever reason. They love Hellblazer. They hate Constantine. I loved the movie. I love Hellblazer. Hellboy. Hellboy caught crap from comic book fans when the Ron Perlman movie came out.
Which is funny because you know who was like the assistant on that? Mike Mignola.
Well, and then the new one comes out with David Harbour, and there were people who were like fans of the comic books, and this was actually more true probably to the comic books, and they still hated it. So there's something about Hellboy where it's such an underground book. I don't know why we're suddenly talking about Hellboy when we were talking about The Watchmen, but I love The Watchmen. The Watchmen is definitely a top five story arc for me.
Yep. Oddly enough, at number five, another Alan Moore story, Swamp Thing American Gothic, which includes the first appearance of Constantine, as we just mentioned, Justice League Dark. If you want to get into Swamp Thing, like probably start at the beginning of Alan Moore. But if you kind of know the story of Swamp Thing and want like a really good, tight, awesome story where you get a little bit of everything, American Gothic's where it's at.
I don't know if telling somebody to start Swamp Thing at Alan Moore. I really don't know if I'd do that.
Oh, you got to. That because the rest of it kind of like when Alan Moore takes over at what was it? Saga of Swamp Thing issue 21. He retells the creation of Swamp Thing, and that completely changes the character to where everything previous to that.
But Alan Moore's heavy. Like, Alan Moore's a heavy writer.
Yeah, it is heavy.
So, like, I guess I see what you're saying, but it's... if you're already a comic book reader, then, yeah, start with Alan Moore. But if you're somebody who's, like, not read comic books but you're interested in Swamp Thing, maybe don't start with Alan Moore.
Yeah, but if you really want the true essence and, like, the... Like, much like we were talking about with Frank Miller completely changing the Batman character... Everything that happened during Alan Moore's run in Swamp Thing, even though it was only, 40, 50 issues, has completely changed that character and the way people see it forever. So, I mean, yeah, you know, I picked my first personal favorite story arc here, but Alan Moore as a whole on Swamp Thing, holy crap.
So, number four on my list, and I kind of wanted to smash this together as two. Well, because of the way that it's written and you know, bringing up Ed Brubaker once again, I wanted to smash together House of M and Messiah Complex because they're intertwined. They're like the same arc. It's not like it's independent arcs of one another.
It's like part one and part two.
Right. So I want to smash them together, but I will just say the Messiah Complex. The great thing about the Messiah Complex is that it also involved X-Force, which is where Kyle and Yost really came in, Craig Kyle and Christopher Yost. Those guys, the work they did on X-Force is next level X-Force. And I was an X-Force kid. Mm-hmm. So to see that get the respect that it did in the late 2000s, and the way that they did Messiah Complex, where they took characters for my generation who grew up on the X-Men animated series, to see those guys move from the cheeky comic book character, like the characters that are involved in this, specifically somebody like Gambit.
Yeah.
To see the Gambit that kids grew up with and the Gambit in Messiah Complex, it's so well done. Ed Brubaker is one of the best writers of comic books of a generation.
Yes.
And Messiah Complex, it's one of my favorites because I was reading it as it was coming out. And I love everything about Messiah Complex.
That's fair. It's a great story. Next at my on my list at number four, Fables, Legends, and Exile. It's the first little story arc in the Fables universe, and Bill Whittingham just knocked it out of the park. If you know any child's fairy tale, the way that Bill portrays these characters and the way they function in modern society, it's fantastic. You've read Fables, or at least have a knowledge of it. It's kind of hard to describe without giving away the,
without giving stuff away. I mean, it's easy to describe.
Yeah, but I mean, it's basically Fables living in modern time.
Once Upon a Time, the TV show.
Yeah, it's sort of like that.
Yeah, it's a better version of that.
Way better version. You got Big B Wolf, the big bad wolf, who's the sheriff. You got, Snow White. You got all these characters, and they have real problems that are trying to solve while keeping themselves hidden from the real world. If you've never read it, you got to check it out. It's great.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Fables, but like I'm not more of a Fables fan than the things that I have on my list. But I do. It's a great book. There's nothing against it. It just for me doesn't end up on the list. Number three, I'm going to double down on the X-Men because you're going to call me an X-Men fanboy anyway.
Well, you are.
Days of Future Past. Again, playing into the work that they did on the animated series, that was the spark for a lot of my fandom. And being able to read that after seeing the cartoon and the way that it... Oh, man, it's just so good. The way that they did both versions of it. It's sort of like we talked about the difference between like the movie and the comic book, but this one was so much more true. And there was a little while in my life where Cable was my favorite hero,
yeah.
But not really even a hero. But Days of Future Past, it's one of the best pieces of comic book writing. I think if you looked up a top 10 list of top 10 comic book stories of all time, Days of Future Past is going to be on that, right?
I looked up at a couple just to throw some ideas at you, and while it wasn't in the top 10, it was
it's top 15, top 20. It's got to be in the top 10. Like Days of Future Past, it's one of the pinnacle X-Men books, and a lot of people from our generation did go back and specifically search for that storyline because of X-Men, the animated series, and they weren't disappointed when they got it. So
yeah,
Days of Future Past, it's top five.
Great story. Number three on my list, Punisher Born. You always, no matter what decade or writer, the original origin story of Frank Castle, the Punisher, is when, his family gets murdered and, everybody thinks he's dead and he comes after the mob that killed him. You know, that story. But this tells, like, the actual origins of how, like, everything is going terrible in Vietnam. And, like, Frank just has this thing overcome him, and like he basically kills all the bad guys and saves the day and then goes back home, and that piece of him becomes dormant again until it's reactivated. But it kind of puts the Frank Castle was always this way. He was a phenomenal killer who can't be killed, and it kind of just gives some depth to one of the most frightening characters in comic book history.
So number two on my list,
yes,
is one that I had to ask for some of our rules because. And the rules that I had to ask for were how we describe a story arc, where I asked about what, 2 hours ago, sitting in the studio trying to sort this out now. Does this include a single book? Does it include a story arc event that takes place over multiple books? And you said yes. Mm-hmm. So number two on my list is Secret Invasion, which is a year-long story arc across I don't know how many total books, but it was monstrous. It was massive. The complete event started in Avengers and drug all the way through books like Thunderbolts, and it got into the X-Men. It got into Captain Britain. It was in Thor. It was in X-Factor. It was in New Warriors.
Jesus. I forgot how massive that thing was.
The new Guardians of the Galaxy. It was in Nova. It was in She-Hulk. Secret Invasion. But it needed to be. That's the thing about it, is it needed to be because they planted the seeds. Brian Michael Bendis may not top the list of people's favorite creators of a generation, but he might be the most underrated. We need to reevaluate Brian Michael Bendis' contributions to comic books, because the seeds that were planted in some of these books and what it grew into over a year, or roughly a year, it was so articulately done. And the way that he was able to get other writers into the fold without spoiling stuff, this is probably the last chance that we're going to have like spoiler-free big reveal comics. But for me, the Avengers, the new Avengers, and the Deadpool contributions to Secret Invasion, and of course the Secret Invasion run itself, the title, the Secret Invasion books, to me, my favorite, because of course I'm more of a Deadpool honk than an X-Men honk, although Deadpool's in the X-Men universe. The way that Deadpool tied into it was the best icing on top of a cake that I've ever seen in comic books. The way that you picked up that Deadpool number one, and the way that you dropped right into what you had already been reading and realized, no way, that just happened. It did just happen, and it happened that way. And by the way, it spawned the Dark Avengers and Dark Wolverine and all this other stuff that came out of Secret Invasion that was great after the fact. Secret Invasion, I was reading it in real time too, which again, it gets big points for me on this, because my pull list grew to disgusting levels during Secret Invasion, because I was a mark for what they were doing. Was I reading Thunderbolts? No. Was I reading Ms. Marvel? Not even close. Was I getting War Machine in my pull list? No. I wasn't even looking at Nova. But by the time this got done, I had every single one of those in my pull list, because it was that damn good. Yeah. So, Secret Invasion, number two on my list.
All right, number two on my list. I said we're going to have a Frank Miller Batman story. This is it. Batman Year One.
God, I feel like a jerk now.
I mean, it literally, up until the New 52, was the basis that everything the Batman universe, from literally when it came out in 89, until the New 52 started, that was the basis of everything Batman. Not to mention that it dovetails into some of the other greatest Batman stories, which include The Long Halloween, Dark Victory, Batman, The Man Who Laughs, written by Ed Brubaker. Like, that four-book story literally laid out the foundation and basis of every other great Batman story told for literally 20 years. Maybe even longer. And now that, you know, the New 52 event's over with, they're kind of trying to get away from the Scott Snyder retelling and work their way back to Batman Year One. That's how important of a story it was. That's how great of a story it was. And it's not just a Batman story. Within four books, you get to examine the kind of person that Selina Kyle is. You get to look at the kind of person, you know, Commissioner Gordon would become. I mean, it just...
Well, like you said about Punisher, it's depth. Yes. It provided depth.
Well, and you felt it just made you more connected to a character you already loved.
Yeah.
And I mean, how can you not put that at the
That's list? Why I said I feel bad. I feel like a jerk not having that even in the... But it was so far outside my wheelhouse. I wasn't reading it in the time. And when I look back at Batman stories, honestly, I think the two that I had in my honorable mentions, The Long Halloween and Killing Joke, honestly, maybe I did like those more. I understand the importance, but I like those two.
You're wrong, but it's okay.
Okay, that's fine. Number one, as much of a Marvel guy as I have been my entire life, the number one on my list is a DC book. You probably already know what it is.
I know what it is, yeah.
Yeah. How many times in history has somebody that's such a tertiary character, I mean, somebody who is so far off the beaten path in a comic book world, how often does that person suddenly own the entire comic book universe on their side? How often does a story leverage a person into such a stratosphere as a literal tertiary character?
Yeah.
And suddenly they have a major motion picture being produced because of one story arc in the comic books and the popularity that it delivered. It's Green Lantern's Blackest Night. Blackest Night took Hal Jordan from a third-rate sidekick in the Justice League to the top of the DC mountain, got Ryan Reynolds to do a horribly rushed together movie, and yeah, the movie didn't work out, and in hindsight...
Actually, the movie was probably the best thing to ever happen to Ryan Reynolds.
Oh, no, okay, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is...
Oh, it was a crap movie.
It was a terrible movie, and it almost ruined DC as far as movies go. Thankfully, there were Batman movies and Christopher Nolan to help out. But I mean the movie was terrible, but I don't want that to take away from how good the Blackest Night story was, because it took all of the elements of the DC universe, all of the things that DC is good at. It's right there in the title, Blackest Night, the darkest of dark. DC is best when things are bad. Think about the stories that we've talked about just now, all the Batman stories. They're dark, gritty, they're terrifying, they're horrible. That's when DC is at its best. You don't see a whole lot of cheeky, fun DC books. Name a cheeky, fun DC book.
I'm sure there's one.
There's probably a Harley Quinn book, maybe, yeah. That's like cheeky and fun. But like every time they do a cheeky and fun character, it's not good. And that's kind of what Hal Jordan was. And maybe that's why this was maybe the best, is that you took that guy that was... your comedy relief, your, hey, he's powerful, but he's also kind of a goofball class clown guy, and you turned it into one of the most devastating, gut-wrenching, darkest, but well-done stories. Geoff Johns ascended to the top of DC creative based on this. I love it. And part of why it moved to number one is like super personal reasons. It was the first big story arc that my oldest son really got into, and is still very, very into it, and so it's got, you know, personal sentimental reasons why the first time that you get to sit down and read comic books with your kid, it's pretty cool. So it has sentimental reason.
All right, mine doesn't have sentimental reasons, and it might be the darkest story we've mentioned all day so far. Daredevil Born Again, which might be the single greatest story in comic books. You got a little bit of everything. Karen Page sells out Matt Murdock because she's addicted to heroin. Kingpin ruins his life and tries to completely not only break down Matt Murdock the person, but try to completely, to like actually kill him after he breaks him down to the point of mental anguish and psychotic. It's just... Frank Miller wrote some messed up stories about a lot of things, but this might be the darkest, most messed up one, and it is absolutely beautiful. If you've never read it, I don't want to spoil it for you. I don't want to get any more into it than I already have, but wow.
Well, they use that, and I'm trying to look this up. They use that as like part of the basis for the Netflix show, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the, I mean, Frank Miller as a whole was heavily influenced the way the world perceives Daredevil. Because, again, this was a book that at the time before Frank Miller took over was dead. Like, nobody cares about Daredevil anymore. Let's get rid of him. Frank Miller kind of got the project to kind of breathe new life into it. And next thing you know, he's got a TV series. He's got a movie. And he's got this rich dark history that's just beautiful and disturbing, and it's all thanks to Frank Miller.
Wow, that's so maybe one of the there's a couple of impressive things about this particular arc. First of all, as soon as I looked at it, I remember this cover, the stained glass cover.
Yep.
That is so freaking fantastic. But the other thing is that this was done just over a handful of books.
Yeah.
227, 228, 229, 230, 231. 5 books. That's it.
Frank Miller tells great stories in a short period of time.
I'm over here listing story arcs that took a year plus. Well, and the number one on your list is 5 books.
Well, I mean, look at Batman Year One, 4 books.
Yeah.
Dark Knight Returns, I think, was only 4 or 5 books. Frank Miller can pack a lot, hit you in the gut, take you on an emotional roller coaster, all within 4 or 5 books.
Now, okay, that was Year One.
Yeah.
So that means Watchmen?
Had to get bumped.
Wow. I kind of thought that was going to be the one place that we kind of had similarities here. I thought we were going to connect on Watchmen. I guess Long Halloween is the only one that we had on our honorable mentions or top 5.
Yep.
10 books each. We only match on one.
Yep.
That's kind of impressive. All right. That was the majority of this episode, so we're going to take a very short break and come back with some concepts on planning dates for a Comic-Con.
It's a podcast. We don't need time limits.
The Con Men podcast is brought to you by GeeksCon, Shreveport's Comic-Con. You can find ticket and vendor info at geekscon.com.
It's the Con Men podcast. Greg Adams over here and Puff over there, still reeling from the top 5 comic book story arc list. That took a lot out of me. It really did.
Well, you have to, people. When Greg says he was having an emotional conniption fit trying to put this together, that was not an exaggeration. He was over there sweating. He's got sheets of paper balled up everywhere.
I still feel like I got it wrong because you brought up Year One, and I realized that nowhere on my list is Year One.
Well,
and that's a mistake. So we're going to have to, much like the Constitution, this will be amended. We're not perfect. So we will revisit this. We'll revisit this topic. The other topic that we want to talk about today, we always try to talk about the elements to putting together a Comic-Con, because that's what we do on a daily basis. In fact, for the last like 24, 48 hours, we've been in contract negotiations pretty much since this podcast started.
Yeah.
For the last few weeks, this has been going on.
Hey, spoiler alert, we're almost done.
We need to talk about something after this.
No kidding. What else you got working over there?
We'll talk about it later.
No hints,
but we did get an email while we were recording this.
Ooh.
So and maybe I got it before, but I just saw the email while we were recording this. So we'll talk about that later. But one of the things that comes up in some of the conversations that we've had about putting together Comic-Cons, and mostly from people who are fans of our event, but I know that other events have this question that pops up, is questions about the dates, and not just the dates for the show, our particular show, GeekCon in Shreveport, August 21st through 23rd of next year.
Because the building was free.
We've always been in August. And actually, that does have a lot to do with it. When we originally scheduled, we actually had the convention center in Shreveport booked for a different event back in 2015. And we decided to not do that event and do this event instead. And so we've kind of just stuck with August as being the date all every year.
Well, I mean, that's because for years the convention center always had this like sort of week blocked out for us, so we just kept it because it was open and we didn't have to do any work to try to squeeze in another hole.
Yeah, and in today's Comic-Con world and the landscape, there's pretty much a show every weekend.
Yeah, you're not going to find a day where you're not competing with somebody else.
Right. So we kind of decided that it was frivolous for us to attempt to try and squeeze in a particular date and in our particular market. And this is kind of the question that we really wanted to hone in on, or the part of the question. So in your particular market, you have to be aware of what else is going on.
Oh, God. I can think of one certain comic event that we have knowledge of that someone booked into a facility that was also the site of a Frisbee tournament and a soccer tournament.
Yes. So you have to be mindful of what is going, not just in that facility, but in your city and your market, too. So if there's like a big art fair downtown on the weekend that you're thinking about,
probably do another weekend.
Yeah, maybe look for something else. If you're going to butt up against the big free summer concert in your city, if you're too close to Christmas, if you're just after Christmas, like January shows to me just seem like they're, I don't think I'd ever do a January show. I mean, you're coming off from where everybody just got done spending all sorts of cash for Christmas and then to have them turn around. Now, there is the allure of thinking, you know, well, people are going to get
money for Christmas.
Money for Christmas.
But they're also exhausted because it's been literally Christmas nowadays is a month-long marathon.
More than a month. I mean, we're starting Christmas celebrations in October.
Well, I'm just saying, like, for the entire month of December, not just through December 25th, it is a marathon of shopping and wrapping and Black Friday, Cyber Monday, this, that, where by the time the month ends, people just want to chill out.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of a January show. And I know there are some shows that find success in January, and that's great. For me personally, I wouldn't want to, like, that's a lot of effort. I'm already neurotic. I don't want to tack extra stuff on.
God, you're telling me.
But you do have to be mindful of the calendar, and you have to be mindful of what other events are taking place in your market. That's for your event dates. But there are a bunch of other dates that you have to take into consideration, too.
Yeah, you got to figure out when you're putting tickets on sale, when and how you're going to make announcements, how you want to schedule them for the most impact. There's a lot of things that go into this.
And that's outwardly facing, too. You have to also make decisions for yourself internally about, like, vendors.
Deadlines.
So, like, for us, we have an opportunity for returning vendors to sign up before the end of the year and get the previous year's vendor rate locked in. We've talked about rates for vendors and tickets before on a previous episode, but oftentimes because the way that the world works, your costs are going to go up, which means sometimes vendor booths have to go up. It could be as small as $10. It could be as high as $100. So if you have an opportunity to lock in previous vendors
and make them happy,
give them a thank you, and keep them coming back, find an opportunity to do that. And we've been able to do that this year, but you have to set that date deadline. So like we did, it's December 31st. If you get your booth set before December 31st, you get last year's price. After January 1st, it's going to be the new price.
And here's the important thing. If you're going to do that, you have to stick to it. Because as soon as you, it's the old saying, once you do it for one guy, you got to do it for all of them. Because they're like hens where it's a small community. I don't mean that negatively, but, you know, it's a small community. People will talk. And if you gave Jane a discount on her booth, but Bob comes in and has to pay full price, Bob's not going to be happy about it. So you got to set whatever your deadline is, whether it's with, you know, your own staff, salespeople. I'm going to put tickets on sale this day. You got to do it because once the kingdom starts crumbling, it falls down fast.
And as far as tickets go, I'm a firm believer in once you're capable of having tickets on sale, put them on sale.
Yeah, you're not going to hurt anything.
Yeah, the longer you have tickets on sale, probably the better you are. Now, it could be a little ridiculous to have year-long ticket sales. I know some shows that do that. That's great if they can keep that up. For me, I always find it difficult because we're trusting. If you're an event who only does paper tickets, don't do that because you're going to have people lose their tickets. They're not going to be able to maintain that ticket for a year. And when they come asking you to replace a ticket that they've lost or destroyed and you have to tell them no, you're the bad guy now.
Oh,
or
yeah.
You eat tickets. It's one of the two. So if you have paper tickets only, if you're only doing physical tickets, only sell them in close proximity to the event, like a couple weeks out. If you're using an online service, that makes it a little easier because people can access their tickets through their email or through the site.
But you say that, but the further you have it out, the more people like, well, I'm moving. I already bought a ticket. I need a refund. And you still got to be the bad guy in that situation. So probably, what, 4 to 6 months?
I enjoy the 6-month aspect. I think 6 months is a good number. because it gives you an opportunity. Now, it also depends on where your show's at. We are positioned in our particular area. School starts a little earlier than a lot of places. So we are just after school gets back. But that means the hot and heavy part of our promotion lands in the summer, where people are taking vacations. Family vacations are in full effect. So we actually have weeks. There's probably not a week. Once maybe April hits, there's probably not a week where our entire market is intact, where yep. there's not a good segment of our community who has left for a vacation somewhere. So for me, if we, being positioned in the late summer, if we're able to start ticket sales in the early spring to late winter, if we give ourselves 6 months over that summer period, I think that's solid. Now, if your event is in the first quarter of the year, you're going to need to have tickets on sale in the fall of the year before, but that gives you a huge advantage because now you can do Black Friday, you can do Christmas sales, mm-hmm. you have opportunities that a show like ours can't really take advantage of because we're a late August show. If we were to put tickets on sale for Black Friday, we're into that weird, weedy territory where we got to rely on people to hold on to their tickets for almost a year. Again, like you brought up, life events change, things change. It's hard to make plans that far in advance. So we don't really get to take advantage of those. If you're in the first quarter of the year, you totally can. Even if you're an early summer show, you can take advantage of that. But I go back to this. That's if you have online sales. If you don't have online sales, I do not recommend doing them more than a month out from your show. I'm trying to think, what's the other date that we were talking about?
Let's see. We
guest announcement dates, I guess, is one that we've kind of been toying with ourselves.
What we do, basically, is we sit down and look, all right, we got X amount of people coming. We want to get in that 6 months window. So if we did one a week, we have this many weeks we have to fill. If we do a big blowout, we have this many weeks. Well, how many of these can we recycle? Basically, we sit in the blackboard and do dumb math and try to be like, all right, this makes sense leading up to our event.
Now, we've talked about breaking that mold, too, because it's always good to attack yourself a little bit on these mm-hmm. events. So we've explored the idea this year of instead of pacing announcements for a few months, we've toyed with the idea of doing it like a music festival and like announcing everything at once or like in a 1 week span and putting tickets on sale that same week.
Oddly enough, when we kind of toyed with that and sort of leaked it out to a few people just to get a response, they were not in love with it.
No, now when we put it out sort of semi-publicly, we got some pushback. But when I asked a couple of people individually, they could see the merits in doing that. I think the pushback was that they haven't seen that. I don't think I've seen that a lot where a show announces everything like a music festival.
I think people just like the surprise and like, ooh, I know next week I'm going to get a guest announcement. It's just something to look forward to.
Now, for us, we've also been debating about how early we can do one. Like we just talked about with our ticket sales, we don't really want to do ticket sales too early. But our guest announcement's okay that early. And we've kind of toyed around with the idea of doing like a Christmas special guest announcement.
Yep.
Which will be way before tickets go on sale. But it's kind of a fun little treat to give fans of the show something to look forward to. Kind of like a, oh, by the way, Merry Christmas. Here's our first guest announcement.
And because of when we're kind of looking for tickets to go on sale, it kind of gets the engine rolling from like the not dead sleep, because we're still pretty active on social media, but kind of get that audience, the train rolling down the tracks as we barrel towards February and March, where we're kind of looking at ticket sales and some other things. So it kind of jump starts the engine before we hit full speed.
Which is maybe the ultimate, the thing that I think is important when it comes to dates. You don't have to be secret about your dates. Like, announce them ahead of time. Like, we're going to go ahead and make an announcement here probably in a couple weeks that lays out some really important dates for our show.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the only date that we've announced so far are the dates of the show and when our returning vendors get their discount. After that, we haven't really laid out many dates, but we're going to have the ability to put out a lot of dates ahead of time and be very transparent so people know what to expect, when to expect it.
It's like a TV show. Hey, The X-Files comes on Friday at 8. That way they know, like, oh, hell, Friday at 8, I better be here because this is going to happen. I love this show. Hey, GeekCon's going to make some sort of announcement on X date. I better be looking forward to that. It's appointment viewing, basically.
Yeah, and it allows people to make plans, potentially. Mm-hmm. Like, some of the dates we're going to announce are not the kind of dates you need to put in your phone as, like, a calendar reminder. But when it comes to things like vendor sales, tickets going on sale, that sort of thing, those are dates that people may actually want to have in their phone. So be upfront with them. Tell them as early as possible. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's always nice that sometimes we take for granted, like, this isn't that important. But to some people, it's super important, and they will get pissed at you that you didn't tell them that X is coming.
Yeah, so, we've had that too. Yeah. So transparency as best you can, especially with your dates. That's the best advice I think that we have. Usually at this point in the podcast, we do our tell a story where we pull a theme out of Chewbacca's head and we talk about it. Because we did the long favorite story arcs, what is this?
Well, instead of pulling a question out of a head, we were just talking about this in the hallway before we got into the comic book discussion, and it's a hilarious story about Lou Ferrigno wrestling a bear.
All right. Let's go ahead and pretend like we're pulling it out, and we'll say, okay, tell your favorite Lou Ferrigno story from when he was at GeekCon 2017.
Yes, and Lou Ferrigno, he wrestled a bear twice, by the way, which might be the most insane thing, because the first time didn't go so well. But as the Incredible Hulk, he got into a fight with a literal 600-pound grizzly bear. It was a trained wrestling bear. Everything was supposed to go smoothly. But basically, the director and animal handler didn't give a lot of instructions, so they're standing in a river. The bear's a little bit agitated and literally starts boxing and biting and fighting with Lou Ferrigno. So Lou, the Incredible Hulk, had to literally hulk up and wrestle this freaking 700-pound bear. Like, if you ever watch it back, the bear's covered in paint. You can see, like, legit scratches and stuff on Lou. I mean, if you ever meet the man, if you ever see him, get him to tell you that story, because he tells it way better, because he literally had to fight a bear.
Lou Ferrigno fought a bear. Okay, I'm torn between my two favorite Lou Ferrigno stories. I'll make very brief ones. First, Lou Ferrigno is a legitimate deputized sheriff's deputy.
Yep.
He's a police officer. So when he came to GeekCon back in 2017, the Caddo Parish Sheriff's Department and Sheriff Steve Prater deputized Lou Ferrigno. Now, the funny thing about this isn't really the Lou Ferrigno side. It's the Caddo Parish Sheriff Steve Prater side, where when he got there and, like, really realized that this is the Lou Ferrigno, this is the freaking Incredible Hulk, he wanted to have the best badge available that he could give him. So we had to delay the ceremony so somebody could run back to Sheriff Prater's desk and get the badge that he wanted to give to Lou Ferrigno. The second story is, well, do I want to tell this story?
Yes, do it, do it, do it, do it, do it, do it.
We'll save this one for another time.
Ah,
yeah, we'll save that Lou Ferrigno story for another time. All right, that's going to be the podcast. We went longer than we've ever gone before. We've set a new record. This is the longest podcast we have in the history of the Con Men podcast.
It's a podcast. It doesn't matter how long we can go.